From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we say goodbye to a venue with so many memories for Pistons fans, the Palace at Auburn Hills.
It's different when you feel like you're moving out of an old house and it just doesn't feel suitable anymore. For what the Palace was, even in the final year, and it had been around for 30 years, it was still one of the better arenas around the league.
We're looking back on the eve of the Palace's demolition. Also, some real talk from an epidemiologist about masks. Sure, they're not super fun.
We should be sort of acknowledging the fact that, yeah, it's much harder to breathe, but the benefits of wearing a mask seem to pretty heavily outweigh the risks.
And we touch base on summer concerts, including an all-star show in Detroit that's going around the world.
And the interesting thing is when we talk to the people who do this, they say that this coming from Detroit is really going to be the important part of it.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, many summer festivals have been canceled because of COVID-19, but music fans and artists are eager to get back to the stage.
When you have large crowds who want to celebrate and hug and cheer, and you have to decide whether or not it's really worth it to take those kinds of risks.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, the venue that survived Van Halen, as well as the full power of Joe Dumars and Isaiah Thomas in their prime, not to mention one of the biggest on-court brawls in NBA history, gets its last dance this weekend with the Demolition Crew. The Palace of Auburn Hills, an iconic spot for so many Michiganders, hosted nearly three decades of Pistons games, including three world championships. And can we talk about that amazing Janet Jackson show that you and your bestie went to back in 1990? The Palace has not been used for events since 2017. Several deals to revive its operations have all fallen through. The Pistons owner, Tom Goris, and Livonia's Shostak brothers are getting ready to dynamite the main structure this weekend and redevelop the site as office buildings and R&D industrial space. Rod Beard is the Pistons beat writer for the Detroit News, and he joins us now. Rod, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, thanks for having me back. I appreciate the opportunity.
What memories do you have of the Palace?
I just remember the last season where it's different when you feel like you're moving out of an old house and it just doesn't feel suitable anymore. The Palace always felt like it was still one of the top third or top quarter of the arenas in the country, even in that last season, because Tom Goris had put some additional money into getting a new, bigger scoreboard, getting some of the seats refurbished. So it just never felt like it was out of date. It was just time to get a newer and cleaner thing or bigger facility. But for what the Palace was, even in the final year, and it had been around for 30 years, it was still one of the better arenas around the league.
For sure. You must have gone to countless games there. Did you ever see a show at the Palace?
Yeah, I think I did see that same Janet Jackson show at the Palace as well. And just some of the other ones. But it was beautiful for and the setup was very good for concerts as well as sporting events. And the thing to remember is that it wasn't just the Pistons. I mean, the Vipers were there, the Shock were there, the Indoor Soccer League. I mean, it just any number of things you could go to the Palace and see. And arena football as well.
Sure. When the Pistons left the Palace circa 2017, 2018, the move opened the door for the team to be part of the downtown renaissance. But a lot of fans and even some players felt kind of blue about it. I know Rasheed Wallace kind of has said that he thinks it, you know, it was a mistake to leave when they did. Do you know how Bill Davidson saw the move?
I think it would have been for him kind of returning to, I think he was more interested in moving to the suburbs and providing a different opportunity for people, even in the choice to leave Joe Louis Arena when the Red Wings were going there and his decision to go to the Silver Dome, which just absolutely was not built for basketball at all. He would rather have gone there for a decade until the Palace got built and then, kind of start up with that. So I don't think going back to Detroit and being in the inner city of Detroit was necessarily what he would have wanted. But I mean, you have to give Bill Davidson credit too for financing all of the building of that pub through private funds and not taking a tax break in order to do it or taxpayer money to do it either.
For sure. I mean, the Palace would have had its place in history for that if absolutely nothing else. We hear, and I think you mentioned too, that the building was still in reasonably good shape when it fell out of use. Is it disappointing to you that no one's found something to do with it?
Well, I think they will. The Tom Gore's ownership group will find a park, a business park to make out of it. And they'll do fine in financially from that. But it was always just really weird the way that it was placed out in Auburn Hills, that there was always the intention that they were going to build restaurants or something near it to make it a little bit more accessible and friendly. Because if you went before a game, there weren't bars or restaurants or other things to do around the palace. You kind of had to stop off in Troy or somewhere else before you got there in order to enjoy yourself before a game. And then even after, there weren't things that were on Lapeer Road or really close by that you could just go and say, hey, after the game, I'm just going to go and have dinner with some friends or just hang out with some friends. That wasn't really there very close to the palace. You again had to drive a little bit further out to get those amenities.
How do you think the move back to the city has worked out for the Pistons?
I think financially, I think they've at least broke even, because although there are fewer fans because the Pistons haven't realized that success yet, the ticket prices are a little bit higher, and they got what they wanted in terms of better suites and higher ticket prices for a newer arena, which you would expect. That there is this idea that less is sometimes more. And so there are several clubs within the Little Caesars Arena. And so for a lot of fans, it goes back to what Palace was for a little bit. It was Star Central, and it was folks who wanted to go to the game as an event, not necessarily as a sporting event, but as a social event. And you can hang out in the various clubs that are there and enjoy some beverage, enjoy some food, hang out with people, and not necessarily just be glued to watching the game. It's an entertainment experience on top of the basketball game.
Do you think we've seen the last of privately funded arenas?
I think so. And for that reason, that people see that it's an entertainment complex where you can have concerts. And now in the Little Caesars case, that it is outdoor concerts that you can have, because there's so much room around the arena in that neighboring space that you can have an outdoor concert if you wanted to. They've already had a basketball function there, which is a 3-on-3 tournament that they had last summer. So they're making use of that outdoor space and making it more of a community space. Even in the Pistons practice facility that they built in Midtown, it's the same sort of thing. There's a plum market there, and they want to make that a community space where people can come in and do some shopping if they want. And they can make use of that more than just this. There's a barrier around it, but you can feel free to come in and grab some groceries. There's a fitness center that's also in there that the public can use and have access. So, I mean, it's more than just, hey, it's walled off from everyone and you can only come for games or you can only come for events. The practice facility is an example of one that it's a piece of the community. You can go in and do different things there any day of the week.
I mean, I guess this is the $64,000 question, but I do wonder if any kind of financial model for arenas is going to hold up past the COVID era.
Yeah, it's everything's up in the air with that. You just don't know how the stock market's going to react, how real estate's going to react, how we can recover from this in any kind of short-term or long-term period even of how this is going to work. And we're seeing that even when there are no sports, you can play the games there. But again, everybody's in it to make money. And if you don't have fans and you're not selling concessions and parking, then it's going to cut into your revenue.
Are you going to watch the demolition this weekend?
I think I will. I think I'll tune into it and kind of see how that all works. And it's not in a sad sort of way, but again, it was something that had been around for so long. And if you've been to a lot of events there, then you know just how special that place was. And even during the Pistons time when they were in their heyday and winning championships, again, it was the place to be. That Anita Baker was there. Tommy Hearns was there. You couldn't get a ticket. You had to know someone to be able to get a ticket and go in there. So there is some of that fondness, but it as things go, it's just time and you have to move on to the next thing.
You know, there was so much criticism of the Palace's location in Auburn Hills. Basically, if you lived in the northern suburbs, it was great, but it was hard to get to for everybody else with not a lot of amenities around. Do you think that location played a role in the Palace's downfall?
Well, I think it's just that the Tom Gores group and the new ownership group, that was their main focus, was to get the Pistons back downtown. So even though the Palace was in good shape, they looked at the finances of it. And the altruistic sort of motive was just get the Pistons in a position where they can be the city's team and a public team, that they can have that community use. And I think that's what they saw in the tea leaves, was that it wasn't going to be that. There wasn't going to be a big entertainment district around there. And that's why they decided to make the move.
Rod Beard writes about the Pistons for the Detroit News. Rod, thank you so much for talking with us.
Anytime. Thanks for having me back.
We are pleased to announce that one of Michigan summer's great joys will be reopening on a limited basis this week. Cedar Point is welcoming guests starting this weekend.
To keep the environment as clean as possible, we've enhanced our hygiene and sanitization procedures throughout the park. This includes additional deep cleaning of busy areas and reducing crowded spaces. High traffic areas like the midways, restrooms, dining locations, and rides and attractions will all receive extra attention with sanitization.
There will be face masks, of course, and hand sanitizer. You have to schedule the day and time you want to go there. And the parks are only admitting 20% of their usual capacity. Do you think they'd consider doing days like this once the pandemic is over? You know, it's amazing to hear that the coasters are going to be running again. And I can attest there is at least one 10-year-old kid in my household spending her first summer as a Michigander who is begging to go. But think about what that day's going to be like. Would people really social distance in lines? All those handrails. I mean, is there enough alcohol in all of Michigan's distilleries to make that right? I sure hope so. And then there's the matter of that first big hill on the Millennium Force. People, I'm here to tell you. There's going to be some aspiration. Of course, you could always go the route of the amusement park in Japan, profiled on All Things Considered this week, which asked patrons to maintain silence on the ride to avoid viral transmission. As an alternative, the park suggested that as you enjoy the ride, you merely scream inside your heart. Good luck out there, coaster fiends. In other news, Detroit's World Music Festival, the Concert of Colors, goes broadcast and webcast only this year.
When we talk to the people who do this, they say that this coming from Detroit is really going to be the important part of it.
That's next. Stay with us.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. While many music festivals in Michigan have canceled, Concert of Colors normally occurs this time of year, but is revamping itself for a broadcasting and live streaming version this coming October 7th through 10th. The Detroit-based Concert of Colors is a whole ethos, presenting a range of acts spotlighting the full power base of the region's musical community, curated by Don Was. It's a who's who of folks you need to know. From household names like Martha Reeves and Mitch Ryder to international stars and local talent. And it's possible that its message carries more punch than ever this year. With us today are the show's founder, Ishmael Ahmed. Ishmael, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, thanks for having us.
And Andalisi is with us too, the host of Essential Music on WDET, which is one of the channels carrying the special on July 12th this year.
Thank you for having me.
We should mention that Ishmael's show, This Island Earth, is also a staple of WDET broadcasts. So before we talk about the present reality that all concert programmers are dealing with, Ishmael, could you share with folks who may not be as familiar how Concert of Colors got started?
Well, Concert of Colors started out with a bunch of different things. Its predecessor was something called Rock Against Racism, where we would go into neighborhoods where the Klan was using music to organize in Detroit and bring in a bunch of bands of color to win over young people. And then later, New Detroit wanted to bring together the communities of color. And at that time was Black and White. New Detroit was started after the 1967 rebellion to bring those that have and those that don't together. So it had been a black and white coalition until I actually was the first person of Arab background to join New Detroit. And I was the vice chair of New Detroit at the time and also the head of its racial justice committee. And I was asked to try to find a way to bring together the different communities of color, Asian, Native American, and others. So we started doing things in the neighborhoods, and they were hugely successful. And they were organized by all of us. And so they represented the different communities, and the turnout represented that. Then we were asked by Mary Young to do it at Shane Park. And then it officially became the Concert of Colors 28 years ago and expanded hugely to include every ethnic community, all kinds of music. Then Don Was joined us about 12 years ago, and we developed a Detroit emphasis. So a lot of music from Detroit, but from all over the world.
Why was it important for the concert to go forward this year?
Well, it's our 28th year, and it's become a beloved festival in Detroit, a real part of Detroit in bad times and good. In particular, it focuses not only on diversity, but questions of community and justice. And so this year in particular has a super value. And we at first were going to just put it off for a year, but as we looked at it, the people at the DIA, which now house the Concert of Colors, as does Culture Source, suggested maybe doing it virtual. And at first, I thought that's a bad idea. There's so much virtual stuff. A lot of it's not very good. And it's mostly streamed. It has fairly small audiences generally. But then I talked to Rich Homburg at PBS, WTVS, Channel 56, and he really liked the idea, and DIA had a little money to do it there. And then we talked to the folks at WDET, and we got a simulcast for 4 days, 8 hours, 2 hours a day in prime time. So it's not just being streamed on YouTube, which it will be, but it will be on a major television station and a major radio station.
And I know that you're something of a connoisseur of this emerging new world of online live music streams. How do you think about the way to make this happen in a way that does cut through the noise and doesn't become, you know, just another streamed event that maybe people are checked into or maybe not?
Well, the fact that Don Was is so passionate about it, and given how well-respected he is around the world, that is certainly a part of why this is going to be so attractive to people.
So it starts with the bookings, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And having him be so dedicated to this and to coming back to Detroit shines a light on what we do and what Ishmael's been doing for decades. So I think that is a big part of this. The other thing is that people that really, really love music get to see some of the best musicians that are right here in Detroit perform live. And so the irony of all of this is that everybody that is going to be performing as part of the Don Was All-Star Review and the Concert of Colors are going to be performing to the biggest audience ever with no audience in front of them. because of, and I know it doesn't really make that much sense, but it's really how it will play out because there are so many outlets for which people to see it. And I think, you know, the fact that people around the world will be able to watch it and people in Metro Detroit who maybe never went to the Concert of Colors might be introduced to it for the very first time because of the way it's going to be presented this year. So I'm very optimistic and very hopeful. We are, you know, when we shoot all these performances, we will be doing it very, very safely. We're excited, you know, to expose some of these artists to the world. And, you know, we couldn't get everybody originally that we wanted because they were all booked. And now, since everybody is staying home and musicians are not touring, we had people that we thought we couldn't get, we got them.
How is the lineup shaping up? Can you tell us?
We had talked about, actually, Ishmael came up with the idea last year of doing blues music. And I think it was Don who suggested doing a tribute to John Lee Hooker. And since John Lee Hooker is a Michigander and spent an awful lot of his time in Detroit, it felt like a really good idea to do a tribute to John Lee Hooker. And so we have everyone from Laith El-Saadi, you know, who was brought to prominence in a bigger way than in Detroit during his time on The Voice. The War and Treaty, who now have been touring the world, so it seems, they were not going to be able to join us. They are going to be able to join us. And they did their first Detroit performance at the Concert of Colors as part of the Don Was All-Star Review in 2017. So to have them come back for this is really exciting for us. And then we've got Chris Canis. We've got Kelvin Cook. Actually, we have three artists who actually knew and performed with John Lee Hooker: Kelvin Cook, Billy Davis, and Emmanuel Young. These gentlemen have an incredible collective history. And so we got all three of them. Thornetta Davis will be there. Tino Gross with John Sinclair and Harmonica Shaw. Chris Canis and Tasha Owens. So we are so thrilled to have this very impressive lineup to pay tribute to John Lee Hooker.
Ishmael, tell us about the pieces that you've been working on.
Well, there are a bunch. One of the things is that the Concert of Colors is also a coalition of the different arts institutions downtown, the Charles Wright Museum, the DIA, the Midtown Inc., the DSO, Historical Museum, Science Museum, the Hellenic Center, the Scarab Club, University of Michigan, and many others. And they've also all been involved, even though they won't be presenting. For instance, Charles Wright will be presenting a jazz thing that will be a lot of top Detroit jazz musicians in a tribute to Charlie Bird Parker. Roy Ayers will be coming to town.
Oh, wow.
He's really perfect for what's going on in the world.
He just made a fantastic record with Ali Shaheed Muhammad and Adrian Young, who people know from the Midnight Hour.
Yeah. Also, we are working on Digging Roots, which is kind of the top Native American band in the world right now. They're in Canada, about 300 or 400 miles north of Detroit. We're trying to get them across the border, and we're hoping that the Canadian border will open up for that to happen. We have a lot of Detroit bands, Orchestra Inspiration, led by Osvaldo Rivera, who is kind of the father of Latin music in Detroit. Sean Blackman will be doing a Balkan European kind of thing. He's kind of Mr. World Music in Detroit as well. We have a band coming from the West Coast, Atitya Ensemble, which is an East Indian jazz performing group, and the vocals are quite amazing. We have many others. I won't go through the list. It's looking like we're going to add another day. We're set for October 7th through the 10th, but it looks like we're going to be adding another day for a techno band, which we're signing, that couldn't play movement because of the situation, but will be joining us.
Oh, wow. You know, this has been a really crazy couple of months for Detroit. And I just wonder, Ishmael, this has always been an event about community and about how we are together, you know, how we rejoice together, how we grieve together sometimes. Why was it important in a moment of revolution to keep this event going?
Well, I think it's because, you know, there are many things that have stood for resistance in Detroit and the world, and many of them are episodic, but Concert of Colors has been an ongoing voice for change and community and resistance, and this year even more so. So I think it's going to play a really important role during this period. I also think that we want to emphasize all of the work that's being done for a better America during this period. So I'm looking forward to it. I do want to make sure that me and Ann get to tell you about the project that we're working on. There are a couple of things taking place when the Concert of Colors normally happens in July. In fact, next week, and Ann and I will be doing a special show together for 2 hours on WDET, and I'll let Ann talk about it.
Ann, please, is this a This Island Earth takeover or an essential? I guess it's sort of the crossover.
Yeah, this coming Sunday, as a matter of fact, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Ishmael and I will sit down and sort of take a trip down memory lane, the Don Was All-Star Review memory lane, and look back and listen to some of the performances that, you know, took place. And they were recorded beautifully. And Ishmael and I will talk about the history of the Don Was All-Star Review. You know, I was lucky enough to join the review in 2015 when we did the tribute to the Electrifying Mojo. That was sort of my introduction, and I've been lucky to have been asked to participate in a more profound way as the years have gone on. But before I showed up, there were incredible performances, and Ishmael and I will talk about those and certainly some of the ones that took place after I joined the review. So it is, this incredible history of performances with packed audiences of people that simply love music and love to see Detroiters play it. And this will just be an opportunity that Ishmael and I have never done. We've never done a show together, and we certainly haven't done a show playing all of these amazing live performances. So that's going to happen this coming Sunday at 11 a.m. on WDET.
We'll consider that the pre-funk for the actual show.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I ask, is there any concern about keeping the performers safe?
Absolutely. The DIA and all of the arts institutes are creating a set of protocols, not only for their opening, but for their usage, and they're fairly stringent. This taping will be very different than anything we've done. People will come in with masks. They will be separated before they perform. Food will be potted. And we are trying to make the best arrangements both for travel and lodging as we possibly can. I know I talked to Don, and Don is a little worried, and I respect that about coming here, but he's made the commitment to do it anyway. He cares that much. And I think that's true of many of the other artists who really think that their art is important to what we're doing and want to be a part of it, but they also want to be safe, and we're going to do everything we can. That's why we don't have an audience. We don't want to put all the great people that have become our community at risk. So this is the best way we can do it.
I mean, guys like Roy Ayers, you don't want to take chances with his health or anyone's, truly.
Right. Yeah. The other thing I'd say is that this is going to be streamed worldwide, and there is a network of world music festivals across the planet, and Mark's Lane Marketing and a group called Rock Scissors Paper, who are national world music marketers and technologists, are going to help us to work with festivals across the planet to get this out as well. And the interesting thing is that when we talk to the people who do this, they say that this coming from Detroit in particular is really going to be the important part of it.
Both of you have a pretty good vantage point from which to see what's happening in the industry right now. Looking at the larger business, that summer touring income is so important to so many artists. How do you see the pandemic ultimately affecting the industry?
Let me say it this way. There are more people than the performers who are being affected by this. So Live Nation, as a matter of fact, launched a campaign to raise money called Crew Nation, because of so many people who work on the crews and travel with the bands and are roadies. That's a very old school term, of course, but who make these shows
happen. But still
very
critical.
Yes, it's very critical. And so they're being greatly affected. I mean, I get an email every day that this tour and that tour has been postponed until the fall of 2021. So it's going to be a while before all of that gets back to normal. Musicians, some are being more creative than others. They're locked down, and so they're making a lot of music. They're all trying to find ways to still connect with their audiences. For some of them, it's going to be a long road back because maybe they play smaller venues and it's going to be harder to social distance and make money and have enough people. So all of those challenges are coming. But I will say that between the Black Lives Matter movement and sort of being stuck in one place and being very, very thoughtful, some musicians are doing some incredible work. It'll be interesting to see how they continue to introduce that to the world. Everything is online. And so for some people, it can be overwhelming to keep track of what everyone is doing because there's so much out there. But I think the business will bounce back. People will need to feel safe and comfortable going to a show, and that is going to be the challenge when the time comes. So for right now, everybody is just in a holding pattern, and it's very unusual because this is concert season. This is when so many things would be happening, and there would be more shows than you know what to do with. So things are different, for sure.
Andalisi hosts Essential Listening on WDET. Ishmael Ahmed is also a familiar presence on WDET with his world music show, This Island Earth, and he is one of the founders of the Concert of Colors. Ishmael, and it's so good to hear your voices. Please take care, and we can't wait for the show.
Take care. Peace, love, and justice.
Coming up, as the coronavirus pandemic has upended so much of daily life, a lot of us have the same question on our minds every day. When will this be over? Public health experts are saying, don't hold your breath.
Without increasing ICU capacity and without a vaccine, this could be something that might have to continue until, 2021, 2022.
We have tips for adjusting to the new normal after a break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The music festival industry is in jeopardy as cancellations have piled up this summer. John Sinkovich has been covering festivals in Michigan for the last 12 years. He's publisher and editor of Local Spins, and he joins us now. John, it's good to hear your voice.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
For those who do not partake, would you say that Michigan had a robust summer music festival scene?
Oh my, yes. Over the last decade or so, the music festival scene here has absolutely exploded. There's more than 100 music festivals taking place during the summer, from Detroit to Grand Rapids to Northern Michigan to the Upper Peninsula, and it's become a real way for folks to not only enjoy sort of Michigan's great outdoors, but some amazing music, because the regional music scene has really kind of taken off too. And on top of that, you got a lot of national touring acts that have found Michigan to be a pretty amazing place to stage a festival. So yeah, it's been an amazing sort of growth in the industry, and this COVID-19 crisis has really pulled the rug out from under that entire scene.
There are some good reasons why festivals were a viable option for artists. It's one of the few durable forms of revenue left for them now that durable music sales are not really much of a thing anymore. But at the same time, even before COVID, there were some failures of large national festivals. I'm thinking of higher profile events like the epic fail of Woodstock 50 and some of the other really big name festivals people had heard about. Would you say that the local festivals were experiencing financial pressure to show that they could stay in the black before this year?
There's always financial pressure. I can tell you that putting on and organizing and booking the bands necessary to put on a major event like that, it takes an enormous amount of money. It takes an enormous amount of time and planning and effort. And many of these festivals, especially some of the smaller ones that are run by nonprofit organizations, are really a break-even proposition. They're doing this because they appreciate the live music scene, and they also have a dedicated audience of fans who are really very much into the camaraderie of a festival. So a lot of these festivals always have been operating a little bit on the margins. Some of them do pretty well, I would have to say, once they're established, but they've always dealt with issues. And even doing an outdoor festival is always an issue when it comes down to weather. You can't really predict the weather, and those can always pull the rug out from under a festival if weather becomes a big issue. So yeah, no, a lot of festivals have always been kind of on the edge.
Yeah. So what is the process that the festivals who did cancel are going through this year? What goes into shutting down your event?
Well, first off, they had to discuss and decide what the state and health regulations are going to be that allows them to have it. Obviously, crowd size restrictions have made it very difficult, especially for the early season festivals, to even consider having an event where they gather a lot of people outdoors. And then they have to decide, well, if we are going to be able to put this festival together, we have to add an enormous amount of infrastructure in order to ensure social distancing, face mask requirements, proper sanitization. Do we take temperature checks at the door? When you have large crowds who want to celebrate and hug and cheer, and you know they're hanging out in front of the stage and exhibit that usual camaraderie that comes with a festival and makes it a special experience, you have to decide whether or not it's really worth it to take those kinds of risks. And I know the organizers of Hoxieville, which was supposed to take place in the Manistee National Forest in August, when they decided to cancel, they put it pretty well. They said, and I quote them, "The inevitable truth is that large-scale events and social distancing cannot coexist, and we cannot guarantee the health and safety of our patrons, staff, artists, vendors, and volunteers in the face of COVID-19. And on top of that, many of these festivals were already experiencing huge drops in ticket sales. And because these smaller festivals and even the larger ones depend on sellouts or at least a certain level of ticket sales, they have to look at this and say, hey, if we can't reach a certain level in terms of revenue, we really can't afford to stage the event this year."
What are the range of workers who are affected by this? Obviously, this is having a huge effect on bands' income, but I'm thinking about sound people, everyone who's working concessions. Who all's getting hit in the pocketbook by this?
Yeah, LowellSpins.com has been spending much of its spring and summer really writing about all of the various impacts that the coronavirus crisis has had on the music industry. And we talk about sound people, we talk about production people, we talk about just the regular roadies, the people who are, this is the way they make their living, especially in the summer on big tours. These folks are not necessarily the highest paid individuals, and their business is always up and down. And for them to have all of this essentially removed for 2020 has been an enormous problem. And then on top of that, you really have the vendors who are also depending on their festival seasons to make money to sell their merchandise. And then of course, the staffs that are related to publicizing and touring with some of the bands. It really is a wide-ranging sort of impact that it's had. And frankly, some of these folks are probably not going to come back to the business because I think it's going to be really difficult for them to know in the future. The uncertainty still remains as to what's going to happen the rest of this year and into 2021.
So are there any festivals that you're aware of that are staying open this summer?
There are a few, but I'm telling you that every week I write more stories about festivals that have canceled. Of course, the biggest festivals are all gone. We've got Electric Forest, Faster Horses Festival. You've got Mopop and Movement in Detroit. They all canceled. Wheatland Music Festival and Bliss Fest, which are like the granddaddies of Michigan music festivals, have all canceled, as well as some of the smaller ones throughout the state and including several festivals in the Upper Peninsula. But a couple of them are still planning to move forward. The Marshall Bluegrass Festival takes place later this month. The Milan Bluegrass Festival in August. Farm Fest is a really amazing sort of regional festival that takes place in Johannesburg, east of Gaylord in northern Michigan. That's continuing August 6th through 10th. And then there is the big ticket festival outside Gaylord that was postponed from late June and now is supposed to take place Labor Day weekend. But I still think that even some of these festivals may make a decision, you know, a few weeks ahead of time, depending on what the situation is. I think things are still very fluid. Some of these festivals, to their credit, are moving toward online live streaming events to try to just sort of keep their brand up. I know Blissfest announced today that they will be doing a virtual festival this weekend when they would have normally had their in-person festival. And a Detroit Jazz Festival over Labor Day weekend is doing quite an elaborate live stream online festival. So there are options, but a lot of this is simply to try to keep their brand sort of viable in 2020 with hopes of coming back in 2021.
I mean, the best of festival experiences are these gloriously crowded, sweaty moments when, you know, ideally you get to see a band that maybe was on their way up before everybody else knew who they were, and it's a very close up intimate experience. I wonder if that's even going to be happening this year.
It may not ever happen exactly the same again. I'm convinced that the way in which we celebrated music festivals in the past may forever change because of the COVID crisis. Now, I can also say that none of us knows how technology and maybe some advancements can help maybe provide that ability to be able to have big events together. But I go to Electric Forest every year, and I can tell you that it's incredible to see the number of people tightly packed together, celebrating, that kind of thing, to be that close and to have that kind of exertion, physical exertion in that tight quarters, I'm not sure we're ever going to see it quite the same again. And I really feel for the indoor music venues, which have been completely shut down due to the COVID-19 crisis. It's going to be really intriguing to see how they end up coming back, because it's been very difficult for them as well.
Hey, John, what do you think is going to happen for this whole string of festivals all across the state that, like you say, we're just getting so much momentum and now this?
It's a devastating blow, not only to the festivals and the organizers of these festivals, but just to the general nature of the music scene in Michigan. Of course, this is happening all over the country and, in fact, all over the world. A lot of communities and a lot of places that normally celebrate live music, Austin, for instance, which has had to cancel a lot of its big events like South by Southwest. But I can tell you that it came at a pretty bad time, in the sense that things were really on the upswing, especially here in West Michigan, with a lot of events and venues and festivals coming to be. So it's going to require a lot of resilience. But I can tell you that a lot of musicians and a lot of people that are really involved with live music are very passionate about what they do, and I'm confident that they'll be able to find a way to keep things rolling. We may lose a few festivals along the way, but I really think that ultimately we will end up back at least to some semblance of where we were before, because I do think there's an awful lot of passion behind this whole music scene.
Well, thanks for checking in. We hope you can stay safe out there when you are on the road.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. You stay safe as well.
John Sinkovich, publisher and editor of Local Spins. We talk to him occasionally about the regional music scene. And so we face another weekend with the need to rest, recreate, and to stay the heck away from other humans who might aspirate a little too close to us. Yesterday, Governor Whitmer and the state's chief medical officer, Dr. Joanne Caldoun, repeated their call that people need to take precautions to slow the spread of COVID or risk a return to the lockdown. And today, the governor issued a new executive order calling for use of masks anytime we're in public. It makes face coverings mandatory in public spaces and requires businesses to deny service to people without one. We wanted to check back in with an epidemiologist we've spoken with in weeks past on the show. Ryan Malish is an assistant research scientist at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, and thanks for having me.
You know, I still run into folks who say that they're not quite sure if the mask does anything. What's your view on that?
Yeah, so I think the evidence is pretty clear that masks do reduce your risk. I think one of the things that we don't have a good handle on is just how much it reduces your risk. And in the exact scenarios, right? I mean, those things are very hard to study, particularly with the new virus that is spread through possibly through multiple different routes, you know, aerosol and droplet. But we do know that certainly someone who's sick wearing a mask will reduce the amount of virus that they put out into the environment. And there is some evidence, actually, some work that was done at U of M around influenza-like illnesses that shows that masks can actually protect people who are healthy as well if their contacts are sick. So there is some evidence that suggests that masks work, and they work pretty well at reducing your risk. But again, that number of exactly how much it reduces your risk is something that's pretty hard to study.
It seems like such a small thing to do. What do you make of some of the public resistance we've seen?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, wearing a mask is uncomfortable, right? And it's something that we do have to get used to. Sort of downplaying the impacts on people's lives from wearing a mask is not something that I think we should be doing as public health, you know, professionals. We should be sort of acknowledging the fact that, yeah, it's much harder to gauge someone's reaction to, you know, as you're talking with them. It is harder to breathe. Those things are true. But, you know, in this case, the benefits of wearing a mask seem to pretty heavily outweigh the risks.
We've been hearing some epidemiologists use a phrase that I think was not really in the common vernacular before COVID, the hammer and the dance. Can you explain what that refers to?
Yeah, so, I mean, the hammer is the lockdown, right? This is the sort of the tough thing that we have to do in order to reduce contact rates and sort of the only means by which we can prevent transmission, right? So that's what we started with. The dance would then be the releasing of those restrictions so that people can go back out and do some of the things, try to return to normal life as much as possible. And so balancing those two is sort of the, when you put them together, the hammer and the dance is sort of the balance.
Right. This idea that we may be seeing months of lockdown and then moments of reopening, I mean, I think there's just not a lot of precedent in modern life for something like that. It's like people living under the Blitzkrieg in London. You know, these periods of relative safety followed by periods when things were not safe.
Yeah, so I think that's true, that it is pretty unprecedented in at least in modern times to think about something like this happening. You know, there was a modeling study out of Harvard earlier this year, I think out of, in April, looking at sort of how those spacing of sort of the release and the lock and the intermittent lockdown would happen. And it was an excellently modeled study. But basically, their conclusions were without increasing ICU capacity and without a vaccine, that this could be something that might have to continue until, you know, 2021, 2022.
Last time we talked, you had some concerns about our lack of knowledge of how COVID affects children and that decisions about the school year should not be made in the absence of data. Are you feeling any differently about that right now?
So we're starting to see some more information, but it's a little bit mixed. I mean, I think we have some encouraging signs. Children, you know, it's pretty clear that they're not getting severe disease, at least the way that adults do, but they're clearly susceptible to infection. We know that from some of the serology studies that we've seen. And, you know, some of the places that have opened schools have done really well and they've been able to control, you know, outbreaks in those settings. And places like Israel have opened their schools and then had to close them back down in certain areas because they've had, you know, some outbreaks in school settings and in teachers. So I think the data is still a bit mixed, but we're starting to get more information now. And it's only going to help, you know, over the next few weeks as we start to have to come to the point where we have to make these decisions.
Governor Whitmer has announced guidance for schools that want to reopen. And it seems like many of Michigan's districts are sort of doing a hybrid plan where kids can take classes online, but there's also at least a partial plan for in-person instruction for, you know, part of the day or part of the week. Do you feel like decisions on opening are moving forward too quickly?
Well, I think you have to balance, you know, everybody's anxious to know what their schools are going to be doing. You know, my daughter is going into first grade and I'm anxious to know what her school is planning as well. So I think developing those plans now is not inappropriate. I think it just has to, the sort of the caveat has to be that if the situation changes, the plan is going to have to change as well.
Yeah. Did you get a sense that the state's leaders are maybe trying to prepare us for that possibility?
I think that's the goal. It's the only thing that really makes sense, I think, at this point. And I know, you know, the University of Michigan, where I work, is doing that same thing. And we're trying to come up with our plans, but it's all subject to sort of, you know, what's happening on the ground. And I heard Governor Whitmer talking about, you know, if we're in phase three, then everything is distance learning. If we're in phase four, then, you know, it's different. So I think they're trying to. I'm not sure how clear the message is, but I think that's definitely an attempt that they're making.
Ryan Malish is an assistant research scientist at University of Michigan School of Public Health. Ryan, thanks for coming back and talking to us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And that's Stateside for this week. The show's produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and Mercedes Mejia, with help from Leah Baldori, Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Please do take care of yourself. We'll catch you next week.